So tonight is the first of two talks I'm going to give on something called the five factors of concentration. Now this is a quite a precise teaching about this stepwise process of concentration that we can consciously choose to follow. But before I start talking about the factors of concentration, I want to talk about concentration in general, just to make it clear what we're talking about before we start talking about what the more precise things I want to talk about. And so, this is, there's three sections I want to read here from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. They emphasize three particular things I think we need to be aware of when we're talking about concentration. And this is part of a much longer section where he talks about this factor. Remember that concentration is appears in two of the key lists. It's in the Eight Noble Eightfold Path. There's concentration, the step eight. And then in the seven factors of awakening, it's the sixth of the seven factors of awakening. So this is a relatively important mental formation. So I want to read this section here first. It is interesting to note that in the Abhidhamma is a, around the time of Christ, commentary on the Pali Canon. It is interesting to note that in the Abhidhamma, one-pointedness is a common factor, which means that it arises at least to some degree in every moment of consciousness. Interesting thought. In other words, concentration. To be conscious, there has to be some degree of concentration present. If there were no concentration or one-pointedness at all, we would never be able to connect with an object. But even though some degree of one-pointedness is always present, in order for us to know anything, this factor of mind is often weak and unstable. The Buddha described this familiar condition in one verse on the Dhammapada, saying, "The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The well-trained mind brings happiness." Most of us can probably relate to the flighty mind, alighting where it will. Yeah, first one, yeah. How often do we get caught up in trains of associated thought before we even realize that we're thinking? But it's important to remember that the mind can be trained and the factor of concentration can be strengthened with skillful practice. The Pali word for meditation is bhavana, and it literally means causing to be developed. Just as our bodies get stronger through physical training, concentration gets stronger through mental development. Buddhist texts describe two types of concentration that help settle the flighty mind. The first is fixed object concentration. This is when we keep the mind steady on a single subject. There are 40 traditional subjects, including the breath, the Brahma-viharas, kasinas or colored discs, 32 parts of the body, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, generosity, morality, peace, and so on. This type of single subject meditation can lead to different levels of meditative absorption, known as the jhanas. So this is where we pick a particular object and our practice is stay with the object, stay with the object, stay with the object. Oh, my mind is wanting to go back to the object. So we just keep, so in any traditional mantra practice is this type of concentration. Simple visualization practices are this type of concentration. The Brahma-vihara practices is like metta, or this type of concentration. So we see this in various ways in all Buddhist traditions, in fact, in all meditative traditions, you know, the Jesus prayer in Christianity and contemplative prayer, and it's everywhere. Okay. A strong one pointed is directed to changing objects moment after moment leads to momentary concentration, the second type of samadhi. When there is continuity of mindfulness, this momentary samadhi remains steady, and as it strengthens over time, we begin to feel a natural, easeful momentum in practice. This kind of one-pointedness does not lead to absorption, but it is the basis for different Vipassana insights. So it's a different form of concentration work. You know, when we're meditating in the Vipassana tradition of mindfulness, like we note a particular arising at one of the sense doors, and then 3 or 4 seconds later, we note another arising, and it might be totally different. So the mind is shifting, but it's staying in the process. The process is continuous. Every 3 or 4 seconds, we're noting what's most prominent in the mind. Okay, so that's one thing I wanted to read. Then, this is quite an interesting thing. It is important to remember that concentration, like all other mental and physical experiences, is a constructed, conditioned state, impermanent like everything else. This means that the strength of concentration can and will wax and wane at different times. This is natural. So, you know, sometimes we sit and our mind is clear and we concentrate quite easily. Other times we sit and it's like a jumble. It's normal. But the more we practice, whether it is the momentary concentration of Vipassana or the absorption jhanas of fixed object concentration, we establish a base of steadiness and strength underneath all the changes. I want to point out that I've practiced both of these forms a lot. And I don't think that one is better than the other. I think the single-pointed forms of practice tend to really build your ability to concentrate more. And then you can take that ability, that skill, because this is just skillful means, and apply that to Vipassana with more vigor, more clarity. I spent, before I came to this form of practice, I spent 25 years doing mantra practice. So I really learned how to concentrate. And I think that was very useful when I came to this practice and started practicing the Vipassana form. Okay. Right. And this is the final section I want to read here. It's called working with thoughts that arise in the mind. Do any of you experience this sometimes? Thoughts arising in the mind during while you're practicing? Nah. Well, I'll read it anyway. In any discussion of concentration, an important issue that arises is how to relate to the many thoughts that arise in the mind. There are different ways of working with thoughts, depending in part on whether you are practicing fixed object concentration, aiming for full absorption, or engaging in momentary concentration, which develops one-pointedness on changing objects. In the first, as the name implies, the idea is to keep the mind steady on a fixed object. So anything else that arises is seen as a distraction. Here we either ignore or simply let go of whatever arises and come back again and again to the object of meditation. In insight practice, on the other hand, when we use momentary concentration to investigate changing objects, there is a different attitude of mind with regard to thoughts. Sayadaw U Tenjaneya has some wise words of advice. So this is a teacher of Joseph Goldstein's. When the mind is thinking or wandering, just be aware of it. Thinking is a natural activity of the mind. You're doing well if you're aware of the mind, that the mind is thinking. But if you feel disturbed by thoughts, if you have a reaction or a judgment of them, there's a problem with your attitude. The wandering mind is not the problem. Your attitude that they should not be around is the problem. This is encouraging, I think. So understand that you have just become aware of some function of the mind. These two are just objects for your attention. Thinking is a mental activity. When you are new to this practice, you should not try to watch thinking continuously. Neither should you try to avoid observing thoughts by immediately going to your primary meditation object. This is a very common problem that I've had a lot of experience with. Well, on my mind wander, I'll be thinking, I'll go, oh, and I rush right back to my breath. And what he's saying is, we don't need to do that. Yeah. When you realize that you are thinking, always pay attention to the thought first, and then remind yourself that a thought is just a thought. Do not think that it is my thought. Now you can return to your primary meditation object. When you feel disturbed by the thinking mind, remind yourself that you are not practicing to prevent thinking. It's another very common misunderstanding about meditation. In fact, I'm going to read that sentence again. When you feel disturbed by the thinking mind, remind yourself that you are not practicing to prevent thinking, but rather to recognize and acknowledge thinking whenever it arises. If you are not aware, you cannot know that you are thinking. The fact that you recognize that you are thinking means that you are aware. Remember that it does not matter how many times the mind thinks, wanders off, or gets annoyed about something, as long as you become aware of it. So this is really good advice, and really good advice about, it's very easy to judge yourself as, I can't concentrate. And that's a place we don't want to go. And this explains why. Even if the mind wanders, as long as we become aware that it's wandering, then the mind is concentrated on the process. You're doing fine. Don't worry about it. Okay. So that's concentration in general. Then there's this teaching on the five factors of concentration. And these five factors are sequential. One builds the next. I want to just very quickly mention the five and talk a little bit about them, and then talk very specifically tonight about the first two. And then next week, I'll talk about the final three. So the five factors are, and I give you the Pali word and the English translation. First one is vitakka, which is translated from the Pali as aiming. Then vichara, which is translated as sustaining. So aiming and sustaining are the first two. Then pitti, which appears on many other lists as well. Pitti often is translated as rapture, which is not a good translation. I think joyful interest is much better. Rapture has that sort of flavor of going off the rails, which is not what we want to do. It's more like, wow, isn't this interesting energy? You know, a little excitement about, you know, you're actually enjoying and excited about what's happening in your practice. This is a good thing. Then sukha, which is happiness. And this is happiness that isn't happiness that we derive from objects. This is happiness that arises purely at the mental level. And then ekagata, which is one-pointed mind, which is the end of the process. So there's these five things: aiming, sustaining, joyful interest, happiness, and one-pointed mind. And I found, as looking, preparing for this online, here's a totally different set of translations, that just because it's interesting to look at things from different places. So they call vitakka initial application. Where do you start? Initial application. I like that. And then they call vichara, the second one, sustained application. So it's not, I'm just making an initial blip. I'm actually sustaining that over a period of time. And then pitti, they just translated as joy. Sukha is happiness, and ekagata is one-pointedness. And then here's yet another set of definitions. So the first is bringing the mind to the object. That's sort of like that, to bringing, and it implies that you're actually doing something to get the mind to go to the object of meditation. Bringing the mind to the object. And then the second one, keeping the mind with the object. Right. And then the third one is, they translate as finding, having interest in the object. Like, wow, that inhale was just amazing. You know, that sort of level of interest. And then the fourth one is being happy and content with the object. And the fifth one is unifying the mind with the object. So the mind and the object sort of get glued together in a sense, connected, not separate. So these are the five steps, the five factors of concentration. And I want to spend some time with all of these. So the first one, you know, aiming, you might think of this as skillful intention. You know, the second step on the Eightfold Path. You know, the first step, remember, is wise understanding. I figured out I got to do something. Because the way I'm doing things now isn't working very well. My life is unsatisfactory. The way my mind works is unsatisfactory. And then we have intention, skillful intention, which means now I'm actually going to do something about this. I'm going to form the intention to concentrate the mind more. So remember, one of the translations I gave was aiming. So it's like you set the intention, you set the aim to note whatever most prominent in the mind every 3 or 4 seconds. If you're practicing the Vipassana, if you're practicing in a one-pointed concentration practice, you aim to stay with that object of concentration, the mantra, the meta phrases, the image. There's lots of different ways of doing this. So it's like we're going to aim the mind. So it's that initial moment where we're going, all right, let's start. I'm going to aim the mind. And it's, so that's on the meditative nitty gritty level, but there's also this broader level of aiming, and that's like I'm aiming to change how I operate in the world so that I can have the ability to meditate, to practice diligently. And where does this intention rise from? Ah, one of the Buddha's favorite topics, renunciation. Now, I want to tell you a little story here. It's a man climbing slowly up with some difficulty up a mountain. Finally, he reaches a small plateau with a cave and an old man sitting in front of it. So you've all seen these memes and cartoons, right? The climber approaches the old man and says, "Oh, great wise man, how can I reach enlightenment?" The wise man says, "Follow the path of renunciation." And the climber pauses. He looks around and see if there's anyone else is on the top of the mountain. And then he says, "Is there anyone else up here I can talk to?" Because we hear the word renunciation, and it's like renunciation has a bad reputation, basically. It's like, oh, renunciation, how unpleasant, right? It's, you know. Also, in recent years, recent being the last 20 or 30 years, as these teachings, both in the Hindu traditions and in the Western tradition, in the Buddhist traditions, have come to the West, there's been this continuous succession of scandals around renunciates not really being renunciates. I was associated with such a teacher at one point. And it's like, and so we hear the word renunciation, and that's what comes to mind. You know, these teachers, mainly men, not a surprise. They're not necessarily just men, by the way, who claim to be renunciates, but aren't. They are, you know, they have a secret life behind the curtain, so to speak. You know, using the Wizard of Oz imagery, and so the renunciation has this sort of reputation within our culture of, yeah, it's just one of those guys. But, and the other thing about renunciation is, like, it sounds like it's not going to be a lot of fun. You know, renunciation, we think renunciation means giving up pleasurable things and having to do things that aren't pleasurable. That's the typical understanding of renunciation in our culture. No, I don't want to do that. It's not going to be very fun. But renunciation is essential to this practice. You can't do this practice without practicing renunciation as part of your practice. And we have to typically renounce things that we usually associate with pleasure, so that we have time to practice. We have to give up some stuff, whether it's, you know, I used to be a huge fan of reading the New York Times, but it took, you read the whole New York Times every day, it's like, it takes a huge amount of time. It's like, great, you're just full of all this interesting stuff and you just want to read it all. But you can just, there's an hour and a half on just like that. I had to stop doing that because it took too much of my time away from other things like practice. Even though it was like one of the great pleasures, I was like, I was so informed. I thought, oh, I'm just so informed. It was like a sort of a mental, aren't I great? I'm so informed vibe to it too. And I'm not saying, and I want to make this very clear, that things that are pleasurable are somehow bad. They're just often distractions. In fact, our habitual pattern is really, oh, things, I don't feel that good. Let's go find some way to distract myself that'll give me a jolt of good, that juicy pleasure stuff. And to quite honest with you, that's exactly what our culture encourages us to do over and over and over. You know, if you don't have this thing, what's wrong with you? If you want to be cool, hip, sexy, blah, 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 get this thing. It's like, and then here's 57 different ways to distract your mind. Just, they're everywhere. Everywhere in our culture, ways to distract your mind. Instead, we have to sort of go, okay, let's aim to have a little, maybe just a little less of that stuff. Maybe we don't have to sort of give it up completely. And we have less of that, so we have more time to practice. More time to study. More time to do things that are useful in the world for other people. To take care of the world more and less of worrying about taking care of ourselves. And that just requires actually examining our lives and going, okay, I can renounce these things so I have more time for what I need to be doing. More time for my practice. And remember, I'm not just talking about formal sitting practice. I'm talking about how we lead our lives. I'm talking about study. I'm talking about dana in the sense of giving to the world, like volunteering in various ways and those sorts of things. These are all really valuable things that need to get done in the world. And these all require renunciation. These are all part of the practice. So at the same time, here's another way of thinking of aiming. We're about to sit, to actually do a formal sitting practice. And we remind ourselves, my aim here is to sit perfectly still for half an hour and pay attention just to what's arising in the moment. That's aiming. And then we have to then keep that going for the rest of the time, which is the second step in concentration, which is sustaining. Yeah. Oh, I want to read something here. This is from Ajahn Chah's book, Seeing Dharma. And it's a quite a nice, encouraging piece of information, I think, that he gives about how to approach practice, this idea of sustaining the practice, which once again, we could look at that in the micro sense, you know, let's just say my object of concentration is the breath. I can aim to see the very beginning of the breath, and this then sustaining is staying with that breath and noticing all the subtle little things that happen in that one breath. That's sustaining on the breath. But there's also this broader context. Ajahn Chah. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness, and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away, but the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It's important to make efforts where this distress appears. We might feel we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there and as we wish and follow our impulses like this world, this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. That's a great image. Read that sentence. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scriptures, there is a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted and eaten rice board from the milkmaid Sujata. So this is the time where the Buddha, you know, the Buddha first spent time with practicing with two concentration masters, and he really learned how to concentrate, and they actually made him co-teachers, and then he finally decided, you know, this isn't enough. And that's an interesting point. Concentration in and of itself is not enough. It always has to be concentration wedded with mindfulness that brings about things. And they cross-pollinate and feed on each other. Okay, anyway. And then he spent 5 years living in the jungle, living this life of total austerity, where he was like living on one grain of rice and nettle soup. And think, you know, like just like the idea being, you know, if I want to understand suffering, I'll just see how much I can suffer. And if I suffer enough, maybe I'll really understand it. That didn't work. So then he decided, he left that group of guys he was hanging out in the forest with. And he met this milkmaid, Sujata. So the story goes. So when he'd accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid, Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, if I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may the dish flow north. So it's a southerly flowing river. And he was just saying he wants the dish to go against the current. Huh? The dish flowed to the north. So this is an interesting point he's trying to make. And it's that this practice goes against the flow of culture, goes against the flow of how things are, you know, how everyone, you know, how our culture tells us things should be and how we should act. And we have to sort of accept the fact that this grating against the culture is just part of what we have to deal with. I mean, I'm sure at some point all of you have had the experience of, you know, mentioning to some friend that you meditate every day, or you come to sanghas and they sort of look at you like, you do what? You know, whether it's like, you know, a relative or a friend or your parents or your kids or whatever, they think it's pretty weird. You know, what are you doing? You know, this is why you do. You're just sitting there. What's wrong with you? You know, and that's just part of what we have to deal with in this practice, is that that's for some people it grates. We grate against them. And they think we're foolish or whatever. That's just part of the practice of being able to be okay with the fact that that's it. That's what's going to happen. Meanwhile, so we've established, set this intention, and now we have to decide how much energy we want to put into the practice. And that, because sustaining the practice, both on the micro level and on the macro level of day after day, after month, after year, after this lifetime, takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of energy. And this is an interesting topic, because There's schools of thought about this that seem to say, know what I say, seem to say that we don't have to do that. We don't have to put in, we shouldn't have to put any energy into this at all. There's this whole thing about, well, that our Buddha nature, we're already perfect. So why do I have to do anything at all? If I'm already perfect, great, I'm done, But in terms of absolute reality, yeah, that's true. But in terms of relative reality, the world we live in day to day, doesn't seem to be what we actually experience. Our day-to-day experience is not that we're perfect Buddhas. Am I, at least for me, I'm assuming for you too. It's, our life isn't perfect. It's far from it. If our life was perfect, we wouldn't, none of us would be sitting here right now. Right? So we know that this is true. And then there's teachings that we sort of tell us that we need to just let go. Sink into our true nature. Sounds nice. It's sort of like let go and sink into our true nature. It sounds so easy. But paradoxically, this takes great effort. To actually sink into your true nature takes a lot of, because this letting go implies that we drop all our usual reactive habits of mind. Because that's what we have to let go, our reactive patterns. Well, we all know that's not easy. This takes an enormous amount of effort. And so this is why we practice. We practice so we can gradually be able to just sink into our true nature. But it's a place we move towards. And even in our daily practice, we might have moments where that's actually what is happening. We really are experiencing our true nature. And we're just in this calm, still space. But then, as you all know, then there goes the concentration, and here we are back again dealing with all this stuff that's going on. Usually where the mind is not paying attention to what's arising in the current moment. We're either reliving the past, stories of blah, 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 this happened, that happened, blah, 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 blah. We're fantasizing about the future. This is going to happen and that's going to happen. Or won't that be great? Or won't that be awful? And then all the emotional content that arises from those stories. That's the normal how our mind operates. And what we're trying to do is train our minds to do less of that. It's not like we're ever going to stop the mind from doing that. We're always going to have thoughts. But we're going to have less thoughts and be able to see what they're doing. What they were talking about, one of the readings, I said, where we actually can be aware of the thought as it arises. Now it's just what's arising. It's not a big deal. It isn't like we want to stop thinking. It's just that we want to be aware that we are thinking. What's arisen right now is thinking. And maybe some subset words of thinking, emotional content or something. But, and this isn't easy. The word, I'm talking about effort here. The Pali word is virya. Or vira. And this Pali word, another translation besides effort, is hero. Wow. So if we want to actually have put in effort, we have to be courageous. This practice takes courage. because we're going against the stream of the culture, it takes a lot of courage to do this, because if we don't have courage, we're going to get discouraged pretty quickly. Remember, that's what I want. Discourage is the opposite of courage. We need to have courage. We need to go, yes, I can do this, and I can do this now. And I don't really care what people think. I don't really care that sometimes I struggle, and I find this practice incredibly difficult sometimes. I'm still going to practice. That takes courage as well. But we have to be careful that we don't sort of get caught in the success trap of this. Like, I'm going to grind it out, right? I'm going to do this if it kills me. I'm going to succeed with this practice. Now the practice becomes just another thing we're grasping. Yeah. Or we get caught in the idea that we should be practicing. What's wrong with me? I should be practicing more. These are just places the mind goes that arise because we think somehow we're not doing enough. And we have to be careful not to go there, which is like, it's called sometimes called striving or overdoing it. Right? Too much effort makes the practice quite grim. If we push too hard, too much, too often, too soon, then practice just becomes really sort of grim and unpleasant, and we get discouraged. We lose our courage, and there goes the practice. So how can we do this? How can we enjoy our effort? Interesting question, right? And there's, I want to very briefly talk about this. It's called the four aspects of what's called right effort. Remember, right effort or wholesome effort is the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. So the first of these is just to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. We're practicing, we see a familiar pattern that we've gone through. We've heard this story countless times. We know exactly what is going to happen in terms of our own emotional state. We're just going to get wound up, angry, sad, something unwholesome, unpleasant. So we go, I don't need to listen to that story anymore. I don't need to eat that meal, using the image from last week. I don't need to go there. And just before it, and so if you can step back and see it just as a bunch of thoughts, maybe you can't stop the story from running because it's so powerful. But if you just see it as, that's just a bunch of thoughts I'm thinking, and not get caught by the story, not get caught by the content, the powerful sometimes content of the story, then it's just nothing. It's just a bunch of thoughts. Often that story quickly disappears when you realize that because it's not succeeding in what it's trying to do. So the second, that's the first aspect of right effort, is just to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. Do whatever you can. And then the second is, when an unwholesome mind state has actually arisen, and there all of a sudden, there you are in the middle of it, and you go, oh, here I am, this is pretty unwholesome. But we're rolling along with it at this point. Then do what you can to make it end. This sounds really contradictory to the traditional instructions, right? Which say just we have to accept whatever is arising. But if this is some old story, like I said, you've heard 1,000 times and now you didn't see it when it first arose, you didn't prevent it from arising, and now you're deep in the middle of it and it's like swirling around, then it's time to go, okay, I don't need to hear this story anymore. If it's something new, then yeah, we want to pay attention to it and really sort of look underneath it and see what's there. But if this is an old familiar pattern, then it's quite skillful to go, okay, don't want to do this. There's lots of teachings in the sutta about ways of doing this. But the most common one, and the one that I found most effective, is often these stories, these things you're caught in, have someone, either yourself or someone else, that other person, that we're blaming about something. It's their fault that blah, 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 or it's my fault. It's a time for metta. You can actually literally, right in the middle of your formal practice of Vipassana, pause and do practices of well-wishing, practices of metta for that other person or for yourself. Because this just breaks the strength of the story. Because the story, instead of it being about, you know, this person did that and then they're so mean and blah, 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 or, oh my God, I'm so stupid, how could I pause? You know, that whole vibe, it's like now we're just offering loving kindness to ourselves or to that other person. Changes the whole energy of the story and the story just dissipates. This is the most common way to deal with unwholesome things that have arisen. So the third aspect of right effort is a partner to the first in a sense. It's the opposite. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Seems really like, duh. Of course, this is pretty obvious, right? But how often do we do this? How often do we consciously choose to do things that bring about calm and joy and compassion and loving kindness and equanimity? We have to think about all the choices we make in the mind and tend towards these wholesome mind states. Do what we can to make a wholesome mind state arise. And the fourth and final aspect of right effort is often the most difficult. When a wholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to preserve it. First off, you have to notice. You have to be mindful enough to see that a wholesome mind state is actually arisen. And this is not that easy because we're sort of programmed, and we have to be careful we don't make this practice into just another part of this program, to look for what's wrong. Oh, this is wrong. Oh, that's wrong. You know, like we're just constantly looking for all the unpleasant things and we're on the lookout for all the bad stuff all the time. And we don't see when the mind is actually quite calm or still or joyful. So we have to, first of all, just be mindful enough to see that the wholesome mind state has arisen. And then, as it says, you know, if a wholesome mind state has arisen, do whatever you can to sustain it. And here's the problem. Often when we feel these wholesome mind states, when we actually do see them, when we've been mindful enough to go, oh yeah, this is what's happening. What arises soon thereafter, if we're not careful, is something along the lines of, I can't be this calm. I need to sort of stay on edge and be watchful. You know, I got to worry. I can't just, you know, I used to joke that with my mother that she was never happy unless she had something to worry about. right? Or even, I don't deserve to be this happy. That's a pretty common one too. I don't deserve to be happy. Well, first of all, bah humbug, that's nonsense. Everyone deserves to be happy all the time, you know. But it's just so, once again, it's easy. It's a habitual place where we often go. The problem with, as soon as we have these sorts of thoughts, I can't be calm, I need to stay watchful, Lord, I don't deserve to be happy. Now we've lost the wholesome mind state and we're back in an unwholesome mind state. Just like that. It's gone. We've done the opposite of trying to preserve it. So there's no magic here. There's no way we can sort of just magically turn this stuff on. It's just practice. This is why we call it practice. You know, it's not called perfection. We're not doing, let's go do some perfection. We're doing some practice. and it's practice implies that sometimes we're going to fail. I mean, that's why they call it practice, right? Practice is like gradually, as I practice more and more and more, I get better at something. Whether it's meditating or playing the piano or cooking or whatever it is you practice. But it's, practice is by its very nature a progressive, slow, step-by-step process. So one last thing I want to talk about is how can we apply this to our regular practice of mindfulness? How does this fit? Well, I already talked about the breath, right? We're trying to aim to see the very beginning of a breath. And then sustaining means we're trying to then stay with all the sensations of that breath as best we can for the entire length of that breath. It's aiming and sustaining. But there's another aspect of this I think is quite important. Because we're noting, if you're doing the noting practice that I talk so much about, you know, where you're noting something and then 3 or 4 seconds later you're noting the next thing, and then 3 or 4 seconds later you're noting the next thing. What often happens is something has arisen that catches our attention, we note it. And then instead of sustaining with that, whatever it is, staying with that for 2 or 3 seconds, or 4 seconds, who knows, some very brief but important period of time, we immediately go off looking for what we're going to note next. It's like, oh, I got this job to do, and I got to, you know, be ready for the next note. No, you don't. Because now you're not sustaining at all. You're just aiming and aiming and aiming and aiming. You're stuck. You're stuck in an aiming loop. You have to aim. And then you have to let the sort of mind settle briefly on whatever it is, whether it's a body sensation or a mental arising or a taste or a smell, who knows, whatever's caught your attention, you note it and then you stay with it. You sustain on that object for this brief. And then at some point, 3 or 4 seconds later, now let's note something else. And if this is a strong sensation, it might be that all you're going to do is note that thing again and sustain with it some more and note it again and stay with it some more. This is okay. This is, you know, that's what's going on. But the nature of all, everything, remember, is that they're impermanent. So at some point, that thing's going to disappear. It's going to become so low level and something else is going to pop up that seems much stronger, and then you're going to note that instead and then sustain with that. This is an important place in practice that we have to learn, we have to have skillfully work with, that this idea that we have to not be constantly looking for the next thing to notice. Yeah. There's 20 things a second going on anyway. So you're not going to ever note them all. So just note, and then sink into it a little bit. Stay with it, sustain with it, and then move on. And if you're practicing, you know, of course, if you're practicing the one-pointed practice, you're practicing metta, for instance, then it's different, where you just want to sustaining really means just, I'm just going to keep repeating those phrases with meaning. That's what sustaining is. My aim is to start at that first phrase and sustain all the way through all four phrases with very clear, precise understanding of the meanings of those phrases, and then I'm going to start again. It's a different form, but it's the same idea. We want to be able to aim to either by noting or by beginning of a concentrated practice, and then we want to sustain. Also, just with the breath. Some people choose to be the breath be the object of meditation, the only object of meditation. And this is fine, by the way. There's a whole sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta, which describes how just mindfulness of breath leads to enlightenment. So some people become very fascinated with just the breath. And this can be a very interesting practice. It's also it can become a very deep concentration practice because it's so simple. Not a lot of things they distract us from. If all we're doing is coming back to the breath and coming back to the breath. So it's an interesting middle ground in a sense. Okay. So that's, I think, all I have to say about the first two factors of concentration. No, concentration in general. I think I probably made it obvious. I think this is a really important thing. Concentration is central to this practice. We have to learn to concentrate more. And as I said, I've gone back and forth where I've done periods of time where my focus has primarily just been concentration. And I've done periods of time when I've been practicing in the wide open Vipassana world, where the object of concentration keeps moving every time I note. One's not better than the other. They're two complementary forms that keep blending together in interesting ways and support each other. So I'm not saying you should do one or you should do the other. I have found it very useful for myself, for my practice, to tend towards just concentration at times, to develop the energy of my concentration. Other people think, it's like that doesn't appeal to them. So I think that's partly my nature. So I'm not even saying any of you should do what I did. I'm just letting you know that this is where we start making decisions about how we're going to practice and changing those from time to time. As long as we're still aiming for enlightenment, which is talk about aiming. We're aiming for enlightenment. I'm going to sustain until I get there. That's aiming and sustaining on the big level. But that's really what we're doing every day. We sit in that question. We're aiming for enlightenment. So, anyhow, that's all I have to say. So at this point, I want to, of course, read a poem here. This is called Snow Geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone. Yet it is ours, not by the century or by the year, but by the hours. One fall I heard above me and above the sting of the wind, a sound I did not know, and my look shot upwards. It was a flock of snow geese, winging it faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were, in part at least, golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes to stop time when something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright, but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if delight were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I have never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What mattered is that when I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. That's a very clear poem about a moment of insight, moment of true seeing. Mary Oliver does it again. Let's share the benefits of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining us.